Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate.
Now listen to this.
Applicable to nothing.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplanes. Any person's not great. I heard you cruising yourself terrified. Zombies coming to your own. Speed up the notch. Keep running. No straight to the mess. Batterman. Air flying down. Black fire. The fire of the citizens. Engaged in the gun. For fire. Sun. Sun.
Clumsy edition of Soma Time as we meander onto the air. Wow, there's another file that just didn't want to upload. It didn't want to upload, folks. But there I go. I persevere in my pirate radio way. All right, this Screwball show begins with an announcement. All those who have overcome their fear and their difficulty in communicating their emotions about the swine flu, we have a sad but, you know, somewhat poignant announcement to make. There's something worse. There's something worse out there, and it's coming for us. So, without further ado, little swine flu music, my friend. Here we are.
Son of a gun. You thought I was
going to
say, son of a bitch, didn't you?
Sorry to step on you there, Porky. But the news is not good. Nope. It is not good from the Ukraine. The Ukraine. I always think of that, what do you call it, that scene in Seinfeld with they're playing on the bus with the... Okay, Flippy's losing it 5 seconds into the show. There's a strain in the Ukraine. I'm rhyming now. Listen to me. There's a strain of flu. I can't even get this out without laughing. That is progressing quickly out there. And we've now passed the point of being afraid of the swine flu here. And we are now crossing over to... the next wave. As we said, we saw this coming, you know, a while ago, because the Center for Disease Cheerleading couldn't scare us enough, and now it's here. It's now time to just embrace this. I need some Russian music. If I don't have any, let's see if I can conjure something up that is applicable here. I don't know. Let's see. And we'll go with a little hoop. They're playing the Super Bowl. There you go. Eventually. Yeah. Tommy, can you heal me? From the Ukraine news agency, Fraza. Dateline, November 7th. Informed sources say it's been confirmed. There is a 100% pneumonic plague in the Ukraine. The agency asserts the head of the physician of the medical institution is sent under informal disposal. Not to sow panic. Oh, no, don't panic. To refute the information about the plague and to speak only of swine influenza. But according to the Fraza agency, Today, in Ukraine, the pneumonic plague is going in parallel with the swine flu. It's the plague, like the blob, has killed over 60 people, about 14 of which had the flu. So here we go, folks. We are now in the era of the pneumonic plague. I just saw this stupid movie 2012 a couple days ago, and now I got to deal with the pneumonic plague. So there you go. I can't take it anymore. I need more Porky music, just to get myself through this. You know, where is Porky? There he is. It's just too goofy.
Oh, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, gun. You thought I was going to say son of a bitch, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought, Porky. But here we are. It's 9:05 on a Wednesday night, and we are now dealing with a plague. I wonder what they come up for that one, because the vaccine, of course, was ill-fated. They botched that galoop pretty much to the point of where it's they can't give these shots away, literally, in the free clinics. Yeah, step up and get some poison in your body. That'll help you out. That'll make your immune system tip-top. Oof-ah. So it's just part of the themes tonight because, you know, last week we had the Trend Hunter on who, you know, we got that riff because, and again, I've been crossing over these lines because I'm trying to bring you the edge. The cutting edge is very raw, folks. You get these shapes on and, you know, they're innovating and they've got a lot of, you know, a lot of kitschiness to them. Some of them are edgy, some of them are a little docile. But, you know, lately we've had some heavy hitters on here, Gary Vee. You know, these guys like that, they come on with a very clear, they got their talking points down, they know how to sit there and swap spit on the phone here with me. And again, get involved in this dopey show. 646-478-4847. What do you think of this? I mean, this is new stuff. The pneumonic plague, I can't even say it, is sweeping across the Ukraine. And we're poised on world destruction. Now, we're watching it. Number one movie in the country is 2012. I did sit through that dopey thing for 2.5 hours the other day. And I'm ready. I am ready for the planet to shed its skin like a dog with fleas, just like, you know, shake itself off coming out of the river. Because it's enough already. It's enough already. We got Obama hopping all over the Orient, getting his clock cleaned. And look what's going on here with the healthcare stuff. They can't monkey wrench this stupid bill through. It seems like every time they get, it's almost like the runaway bride. Every time they get to the point where they're gonna, okay, you know, we're gonna get this done, somebody comes up with another little monkey wrench, and off they go again. So that's not getting resolved. He hasn't made a decision about the troops. We've got an economy that one day looks like it's all right, the next day we find out that they scammed some more money over here. So there's a lot of hope that's been lost. We got to keep hope alive. All right, just in time to rescue me and probably the few people that are listening before the guest comes on, all the way from somewhere north of me. I'm not sure if it's New Hampshire or Maine, but he's up there somewhere. We'll get the horn going here. Submarine. Welcome. There he is, Paul Gersiel to the program, futurist and calmer of nerves.
I'm not so sure about that, Mark, but we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you picked up on this when I was doing a couple minutes ago about this pneumonic plague in the Ukraine is sweeping the European countries over there, and it's knocking people out, you know, like a pinball. And they say this is the mutated strain that they've been waiting for, and you know, people are just like swooning out there. And
what,
they think
the mutated strain of swine?
Of swine, yeah. Well, it has a whole ingredients in it here that is fascinating. Actually, what they can't identify it as they don't know yet if it's swine mutated or, but they know it has, it's Californian. It's kind of an exotic flu. And it's a cocktail of three viruses, mutated single pneumonic plague, far more dangerous than swine. Death tolls reached 189. More than a million people have been infected in the western nine regions of the western Ukraine. And
Western Ukraine.
Yeah. and the virologists are going, you know, the typical response is they don't know, they don't know what it is. Yeah, it's becoming, they don't believe it's H1N1, but they don't know what kind of pneumonia it is. So,
interesting.
The body's
so
dropping all over.
So in other words, these people are dying of pneumonia, not of the flu.
Right, we've advanced. Like I said, we've gone past the flu, and now we're into pneumonia.
I have to tell you, I did not catch the first 10 minutes because I misunderstood your note, which was calling at 9:10. So I follow instructions. See, you know.
Yeah, well, that's fine. No one needs to hear the first 10 minutes.
I was gonna say starting at 10 minutes past the hour is a little odd time, but who knows?
Well,
you know,
I come on and do sort of a news of the day. I get my vent out for 10 minutes. It's like a voicemail to the ether. But he's got. Let's see, President of the Ukraine says. Three causes of viral infections simultaneous. Two seasonal flus and a Californian flu have combined to make this pneumatic plague. So this is what we're up against now. It's a viral pneumonia. So that's. I mean, I don't know. Can Merlin track diseases?
Well,
as we segue really into Merlin.
Yeah, sort of. It can track anything if you have a start date.
Okay.
And in the case of this, we would probably use the first reported incident that that has now become a news story. It's interesting. I caught a piece of this last night on Coast, and I wasn't really paying attention because I hadn't heard the story. So I wasn't sure what they were talking about exactly, and they went on to other things, so I didn't hear the rest of it. But
it'll gain traction.
Absolutely. No, if people are dying, it'll definitely gain traction. What's curious about this is when we get into the prediction business, which is sort of an occupational hazard, it's not really what we do, but it's sort of expected when people understand what the concept is here. My dad is 92.
Right.
He was born in September, early September of 1917. And he made an interesting comment to me, I guess about a year or two ago, when this swine flu thing first came about, and they were talking about it becoming a pandemic. And he said, well, you know, I came in with the great pandemic of 1917-18. What do you suppose I go out with another pandemic? And it reminded me of a statement that Mark Twain had made, that he came in with Halley's Comet and that he would leave with Halley's Comet, and he did.
Wow.
So, timing of things is curious. There would be no particular reason for my dad to have said that, except that we haven't had a pandemic of that size since the year in which he arrived. And it killed, what was it, 100 million? Was it 100 million people it killed? Something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
An enormous number, considering the size of the population of the globe was much smaller than it is now. So, and they've been, they've been waving a flag about this now for a year or two, and I think a lot of us have gotten fairly blasé about it in the sense that, we have the flu and we lose 30,000 people a year, roughly, something like that. A fraction, basically, of the people we lose to heart disease and alcoholism and car wrecks, for that matter. I've often told people when they're agonizing about 9/11 that, as unfortunate as that all was, we lose three times that many people every year in bathtub accidents in America, and I don't see anybody going after American Standard or Kohler and calling them terrorists.
Well, we lose a plane full of people a day to prescription drugs. So,
right, exactly, and it's Well, no. When you're talking about, you know, loss of life, you're talking about it in quantities, and it's just that we treat this particular 3,000 people a little differently than the 9,000 who die in bathtub accidents. But you know, the fact of the matter is they're just as dead, and their families and relatives are just as upset that they're gone. It's just that they didn't all go at once, and they went in a fairly innocuous fashion. But it's a little bit like the way 6 Feet Under used to begin. I don't know whether you ever watched
it
was the opening was always wonderful because there was some fairly innocuous thing going on, and all of a sudden the person was dead. I mean, the one that I had to laugh over was the guy who's leaning out of his car as he's backing out of the driveway trying to reach for the newspaper, which was on the driveway alongside of the car, and as he's reaching out, he fell out of the car and ended up under the front wheels. But, I mean, that's the way things really happen, and this is a little different. If we had a start date for this, the initial report of this, and I don't know what that is because, as I said, I was not watching this story. I know, for instance, that when we ran Merlin on the AIDS epidemic, we used early June of 1981 because that was the first sort of official report of this odd new, killer of basically gay men in San Francisco. And the initial report was in early June of 81, so we used that date as a tracking date for the illness itself. And what we found, interestingly enough, and you can go back and look at the AIDS run, I'm not sure it's in the Time Track library, but we can post it because we ran it back in the late 80s. One of the things that's interesting about it is that the point at which it became a sort of crossover disease, crossing over essentially into the mainstream, and no longer being sort of looked at as a gay disease, you can see an enormous series of spikes going on in the Merlin time tracks at the same time that it crossed over and became a sort of mainstream problem. If one has an initial starting date for whatever it is, whether it's an individual's arrival here, or whether it's the formation of a company, or a marriage, or actually in these days, the first date you slept with that person, because that's the date that really matters these days. You can get a very interesting picture in terms of hills and valleys of where the transitions along the way are likely to happen. What this technology essentially does is it finds beginnings and endings. It finds transition points within an episode. And you can actually see where during a period of years the major events are likely to cluster. You can't always figure out what they're going to be, but you can figure out where they're going to happen in time, like a set of coordinates, like GPS does. It can tell you where in time this event is going to transition into its next phase. And then if you happen to be a good news junkie, as Dr. Hart and I are, and constantly sort of dissect what's going on in the news, you can bring that to bear on the information and make a pretty good guess as to what form that new stage is going to take. So, for instance, when we did Larry King back in the early 90s, this issue of the AIDS epidemic, came up, and we said that at this particular point in time, there was going to be a transition in the course of the illness, and we weren't sure whether it was going to be that they were going to find a cure or a vaccine or what, or it was going to transition into the mainstream. And as it turned out, around the same time that that transition occurred, if you go back and you look at the history of it, you'll find that that's when they first started playing around with what has now become this cocktail of various antiviral agents and so on, which has become pretty successful in being able to manage what was nearly always fatal back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So Merlin was able to find the point where that transition, that transitioning effect happened. We made a good guess as to what form that transition was going to take, and it turned out that it was more than that. It was not only that it became a mainstream illness, but also that that's where this cocktail began to sort of take form and where they began to be able to manage it to some extent. So, yeah, is this a recent story? I mean, did this just bubble up in the last, you know, week or two or three?
It sort of hit our side of the ocean this week, but it's been active over there. It looks like the 30th of October was when the president quarantined these nine regions. Ordered mobile military hospitals established throughout the country. Then they were expected to declare martial law. November 4th, there was a nationwide address. People are dying. The epidemic is killing doctors.
How is it if it had gotten to that stage, even we didn't hear about this?
Well, because they thought it was under the umbrella of H1N1, and they hadn't teased it out yet till this week. As of November 6th, the health minister said there was over 633,000 people were suffering from the flu and these acute respiratory infections, and 95 of them had died. November 7th, they went, okay, now we're at 800,000. So it kept spiking, and it only kind of diverged from the swine this week, where they started saying, hey, this is not what we're looking at here. There's a human influenza. There's a bird flu in there with contamination in there. And some of them looks like they're attributing it to some of the vaccine combining in there. H5N1 virus is a human-to-human thing. So they're all over the map with this thing, and they haven't been able to nail it down. And it's going to get, you know, and there was a suspicion that it was a bioweapon in Ukraine.
Really?
Yeah. There's
been some suspicion that that was true. Mm-hmm. About this virus all along, if I remember correctly.
Oh, there was a woman, I forget her name, that was in one of the health ministers in, I forget what country in Europe, that was basically saying that this was nothing more than a lot of fear campaign to get everyone afraid, and then a population control thing, which is another one of those conspiracy theories that, you know, the people that have the tinfoil on the head are always looking for, and
the only problem with the tinfoil on the head people is that occasionally they actually are on the mark. You know, that's and the trick is to try and figure out when that might be. That's the difficult part. I'm sure you certainly encountered a few of those people over the course of your life, and I certainly have. And every so often I run across one. And they're not easy to dismiss. It's interesting you should mention that, because there's a fellow named Andrew Bisaglio. He is a, let's see, he's an attorney. And he claims that when he was a youngster back in the 70s, he was actually involved in a DARPA program that involved time travel.
Right.
Now, the story is very exotic, but one of my clients happens to be a former Secretary of Defense. And, you know, I offered to put him in touch with this guy, because I figured if this is just a story, he's going to disappear. He's not going to want to be talking to me, because he's going to, you know, because now I've actually, you know, put your money where your mouth is, kind of thing. Well, I just got an email from him about an hour ago, and he's looking forward to being connected up with my client. So now I have to put up, you know.
Yeah.
And I actually was not expecting to hear from. I figured he would, disappear from sight once somebody called him on this and said, "Well, okay, I can connect you up with somebody who can determine how much of this is real." So here he is. So now I'm going to have to go.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to call my client up and say, "I've got an interesting story to run past you here."
This kind of bleeds into what you're talking about, that blurry line between conspiracy and reality, because here it is, November 6th, okay, here's a report headline, it's called the InWorld Report Net, demonic plague outbreak in China follows outbreak in Ukraine, population of about 10,000, little town called Zikatan, two deaths and a dozen infected, the area inside is a 17-mile radius quarantined to contain it, highly contagious, one of the most virulent deadly diseases on Earth. Fatal within 24 hours, attacks the lungs, kills everyone who catches it, unless it's rapidly treated with antibiotics. The same day, the president goes on and gives the report that calming the panic about the swine flu, says this is artificially created by the drug companies. So he's dismissing it, and then there's 10 more deaths, and then Radio Free Europe picks this up. I love Radio Free Europe. And now it says it's all propaganda from the U.S., and now Russia, the Ukraine, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, they're all we're starting to report this. November 4th, swine flu fear spread through Ukraine to Afghanistan. Remember, what was around the time when those DEA guys got shot? That was around then, right? Maybe we were going for the
Nazis. Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Afghanistan has declared a nationwide public health emergency and closed educational institutes for 3 weeks. So we have military, we have big pharma, and we have, four or five communist countries involved here. This is getting a little nutty, and you're not going to get straight information from some of these people. But now, the same day, this is November 2nd, the Ukraine reports over 1 million people are sick with flu-like symptoms, and 52,000 of them are in the hospital. We never heard about that here.
No. As a matter of fact, there's a few odd things about this particular flu, even before we heard about that strain, and that is that since when do the flus kill the young people?
Right.
The over 60 crowd gets hit with these things, and that's where we lose people. We don't lose them in their 20s. The theory has been from the CDC that their immune system is actually overreacting to the acquisition of the flu, and that it was creating pneumonia out of an overreaction.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't really know. It was certainly not something they've been expecting, and you can tell they're a little perturbed by this, because I don't think there's been a influenza that ever sought out the young before that I'm aware of.
No, this is something that's scaled, because in the States we've been focusing on like you said, the two extremes of the bell curve, the babies and the young kids and the seniors, and this is wiping out everybody over there. And
yeah.
it seems to be in a very strange area, that it's around Afghanistan and, around there where we've been having, all kinds of mix between the, sort of the Blackwater type hired guns, the DEA guys, and our military.
Yeah,
and which lends it to the bioweapon aspect of it too. Yeah, this is, like I said, this is one of those stories that's kind of tucked under the radar while we've been, our head's been spinning over here with all the other garbage that we've been chasing, the healthcare stuff and all the things. So let's get
Whether Mr. Obama's been bowing a little bit too low.
Right, if he's bowing, but this is what Fox is focusing on. If he's bowing,
it's
a minutia.
I'll tell you this: it caught my eye tonight, and I was shopping in the local Walmart, and they had one entire end cap on one of the aisles of 20 packs of masks that are N95, protective for this flu now. The interesting thing about that is that about 6 months ago, maybe more than that, when the first flurry of this hit, I went out and picked up a bunch of these masks, and there were really very few of them available. And I mentioned to the buyer at one of the local stores that, you know, they might want to lay in a stock of these things, because, you know, if something actually did happen, there was going to be a run on these masks.
No, what town is this? This has got to be this remote town you're in.
Well, it's not all that remote. I'm sort of outside of Portland, so
okay.
I'm not. It's not really the boonies. As a matter of fact, this is a beautiful little old turn of the last century town, with a lot of Victorian houses with turrets and all sorts of stuff. In fact, I'll tell you a quick little story, which maybe can lead into some other things.
Yeah.
I had been living not an adjacent town exactly, but several towns away, in Lyman, Maine, mm-hmm. and two summers ago, my desktop all of a sudden died, and I couldn't boot it. And I brought it around to various, you know, doctors, and they had no luck with it. And so I had a laptop, but I needed a bigger system. And so the local library, which is a community library in Lyman, it's not part of the regular chain of public libraries in Maine. It's sort of a local by donation community library, and they had a couple of Gates computers there, and so I began to visit this library with some degree of regularity. I got very friendly with the local librarian, who's a wonderful guy, and he had sort of all the local library lore and other gossip, and mentioned to me just in passing that the books in that library had gotten off the ground because of a donation of books from Nasson, NASSON College, which had gone out of business sometime in the middle or late 80s, and that's where their initial load of books came from. And I didn't think much of it, and in the spring this year I went house hunting, and I finally located a place in Springvale, Maine, which is a couple of towns away, and mentioned it to this fellow, and he said, oh, by the way, Springvale used to be the home of Nasson College. Well, interesting. I had been, here I was using the library where the books from Nasson College came from, and now I had bought a house in the town where Nasson College once was. Well, what we didn't know was that the house I bought in one of its earlier incarnations was Nasson College's library. And the books that I had been hanging out around in the Lyman Community Library had come from the place that I now owned.
That is a long way to go, almost nowhere. I mean, that is a Mobius strip of the third order there.
Isn't that a weird little story?
Yeah.
You know, this house was a number of things in its 100 years. It was originally built by a guy who won the Irish sweepstakes, and then after he built it, he ran out of money. It was also when Nasson College bought it. It was, among other things, an administration building. It was also a girls' dorm. Some of the local residents have already reported that this was a place where panty raids used to go on. And in the late 70s, middle late 70s, during that oil embargo, where some of us remember the lines of cars waiting at gas stations and whatnot,
sure.
The college decided that it might be smart to put in a hybrid heating system. So this is the only house I've ever been in or know of that has both an oil system and a wood or coal system hooked up together. It's a huge plant down in the basement, so that you can either burn wood or coal or oil, depending upon what's cost effective.
Well, I mean, as unique as that is, I can't imagine that that's going to become the trendsetter as we go forward. But
well, it's interesting in Maine because the thing is,
yeah.
you rarely have the ability to make a choice like that. You're either burning wood or you're burning oil.
Yeah, it's like a hybrid house.
Very much so, I've been looking to see if there's any ghosts of the girls wandering around, but so far. I haven't seen anybody. But anyway.
Well, in case you're doing this late, this is not, Susie Orman and the Real Estate Hour. This is actually summertime. And we have a futurist here, Paul Garcia from the Merlin Project, who's going to take a lot of the knots out of your head, hopefully, with all the controversy and all the scandals and everything that's been going on this year. We have to get to the point where we can step back and actually look at not just the events, but the tapestry within them. And that leads us back to giving you guys some fundamentals about the way Paul and his partners have been able to kind of dig underneath a lot of the BS, and there's a lot of it, to get to this fundamental truth that he's discovered about the nature of time and the nature of how we experience it. So for everybody that has never heard of Merlin and never heard of anything to do with any of this stuff we're about to speak to, Paul's going to take us through from basically stem to stern on what it is, how it works, and how it relates to everything that we've just been talking about for 20 minutes. So we're going to we put a bunch of dots, and now we'll connect them. So start with your background is as eclectic as the story, but basically to give the listener a little bit of a scene here.
I was one of those kids who grew up listening to a fellow named Long John Neville, who was the overnight guy on WNBC out of New York. And while everybody around me was listening to rock and roll and under their covers, they had a transistor tuned to Cousin Brucey, I was listening to Long John. And Long John used to have a regular sort of potpourri of guests who had had some pretty odd experiences. These people who, you know, had Martians in for lunch or had some UFO experience or whatnot. He was the sort of precursor to a show like Coast to Coast.
Right.
I grew up listening to that, and then eventually over the years when I got a little older, I would traipse into Manhattan and literally sneak into the studios and watch this all go on from the control room until I got caught one night what happened was there's a very famous delicatessen in Manhattan called the Carnegie.
Right.
And Long John used to have a nightly delivery of goodies from the Carnegie for his guests. So he had a table set up with all of these pastries and sandwiches and whatnot. And the engineer on a break went in and loaded up with a bunch of stuff and came back into the control room, and I guess he looked over at me, and I must have been drooling or something, and he said, "Well, you know, why don't you go in and, you know, get some food?" So I went in, and I got caught loading up, and Long John sort of had me banished from not only the studio but the building, and the security at 30 Rockefeller Plaza, 30 Rockefeller Center, actually, got changed as a result of me at that point, and I didn't get back into that building for, oh golly, probably 25 years when Alan
sandwich?
Well, the security obviously got beefed up in a lot of buildings in New York over the years, and certainly after 9/11, but in the 80s, it was a lot tougher to sneak into any of these broadcast facilities. And in the late 80s, Alan Combs, who was half of Hannity and Combs on Fox, was doing an afternoon show, and Alan and I have been friends for years. And I was one of the first guests he ever had on doing any of these things when he was in Boston back in the 70s. So he had invited me in, and the first time I got back into 30 Rock was when Alan was working there in the late 80s. What Dr. Hart and I are doing with this Merlin project developed out of a radio show. I was on as a guest with a fellow in Boston named David Brudnoy, And David used to have me on 3-4 times a year. And then Dr. Hart is a PhD physicist with MIT credentials and very high security clearance from the Pentagon. And he was working in a think tank outside of Boston and was driving home from the think tank he worked at, listening to Brudnoy, and managed to catch me back in the end of the 80s and called up and arranged to get together because he listened to me discuss concepts of time as being something rather unique, kind of like moments of time have a genetic code. Each moment has its own particular set of characteristics that are not shared by any other moment. And that theory of time very nearly paralleled things that he had discovered over the years. And so he wanted to get together and kick this around, and we did. Over the course of 5 or 6 months, after which George said to me, you know, he says, I got a bunch of SDI guys, because he was heading up a program under Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, what we later called Star Wars program. And we were now into the late 80s. Reagan was no longer in office. George H.W. Bush had moved in. And the funding for SDI had been cut significantly. And so George had a number of SDI research people on his hands with less to do than they had and some government Cray computers sitting around. And so he offered, basically, to take this concept of time that I had developed over the years and to see if we could find a way to write a piece of software that would capture the essence of this. And to give you a kind of conceptual image so that you can get a feel for how this works, assume for a moment that each moment of time was like a chord on a piano. Mm-hmm. And you know that if you hold down the pedal, you can maintain that chord. And you could then play subsequent chords, some of which would be melodious, played in conjunction with the original chord, and others wouldn't be. And what Merlin effectively is a graphical picture of what moment A looks like when it's juxtaposed with moment B, and then A with C, and A with D, and A with E, and so on, and then B with C and B with D, and in other words, each moment, each initial moment, is then combined with the noise that subsequent moments are going to make, and a graph is designed to capture what that actually looks like. So what you end up with is something that looks a lot like sheet music, like symphonic sheet music. And if you looked at a piece of sheet music, even if you weren't a musician, you could look at it and tell where the busy, loud, raucous movements in that symphony are and where the changes are, where it quiets down, where it softens up, where there's a change in the complexion of the music. What Merlin does with time is it captures this essence of the moment and then compares that with each subsequent moment down the line and draws a picture of that. So depending upon where your starting moment is, you'd get an entirely different pattern of what time is going to look like measured from any other moment. So moment A combined with B and C and D and E and so on would give you a different pathway into the future than moment B combined with C and D and C combined with D and E and so on. Each one would give you a different pathway into the future, a different set of highs and lows, a different set of a different kind of musical score. And if you use that as a kind of detector for picking moments that are going to be compatible with the original moment, with the Genesis moment of whatever it is, you're actually going to be able to see where down the road this musical score is going to change, where it's going to develop into some other movement or get louder or get quieter or get more raucous, whatever it is. And once you understand how these patterns are read, you can actually look at a Merlin time track and very quickly point out the spot along the way where the activity pulse is going to change. What we found is that at those points in real time is where the events cluster. So that if you took something like this potential pandemic that you're talking about in the Ukraine,
and you have
an initial starting moment for this, you could see where along the way in time this is going to get, you know, worse or bigger or more complicated or, you know, become a bigger deal than, say, a normal flu epidemic might become. And as I was saying earlier with the AIDS epidemic, when we ran that early June 1981 date, which is thought to be the first report of this illness, first official report of this illness, you can actually see where in time that illness was going to go through some of its largest transitions. So, you know, you take, if you go to the website, for instance, and right now there's material up there having to do with the 08 election. The
is that on timetracks.com?
Yeah, if you go to timetracks.org, it's TIMETRAKS, .org, and you look at the dates on which, you know, McCain and Hillary and Obama announced for the presidency, the day they you know, put their money where their mouth was. And you look at the durations of those runs, and you look at the transition points. It would have been very obvious to anybody looking at them that Obama was going to win that election, because McCain's and Hillary's were not only remarkably similar to each other, but not really going anywhere much past the middle of 08, the end of 08. They had no legs to them. They had no long-term characteristics.
So that way, Obama's,
Obama's, on the other hand, shows up as going great guns until around the time frame we're in now, between now and probably the fall of next year, at which point there is a precipitous drop-off on the time track. What we found over the years is when that happens, when there's a, you know, when there's a very loud, raucous movement in the symphony, let's say,
right,
and then all of a sudden it abruptly stops.
That doesn't sound good.
It doesn't sound good. It's very problematic. If you then look at Joe Biden, you notice that. Excuse me.
That's about this time next year. You see this.
Well, sometime between now and this time next year,
okay.
Most likely probably in the summer of next year. That would be my guess.
That's about when the troop withdrawal supposed to go on.
Well, the thing is, if you look at Biden's run, which is also posted there, what's interesting is that at the point where Obama's precipitously drops off, Biden sort of takes off, and you have to kind of look at that and say, well, gee, if there's some kind of a transition in the summer of 2010 or thereabouts involving these two time tracks, the there's got to be some kind of a transition involving those two people. And then you have to kind of look around and see, well, what would the possibilities be? Now, Biden, for instance, has a history of having had aneurysms and potentially could have another one. And maybe what's going to happen in there is that Biden is going to have to step down, and who knows, he might move Hillary into that position or something, so that by the fall or winter of 2010 going into 2011, we'd have a somewhat different, power structure going on in this administration. On the other hand, I understand that Mr. Obama has the largest Secret Service contingent that's ever been assembled. So they must be getting more than their share of kooks and threats and whatnot. And, you know, all you have to do is listen to right-wing radio for a day.
Yeah, right.
And you can certainly get the idea that some of the people who listen to that, who are not among our most educated, you know, fellow travelers, you know, somebody could easily, head out with a gun or something. So there is some larger transition going on before this first term is over, probably in the 12 months we're now moving into, more likely between the late spring and late fall as a kind of window of time. And the change is significant enough that there's some kind of musical chairs going on at that point.
You know,
so,
I'm looking at the chart here on the site as you're talking, and I'm thinking back to when Reagan got shot, you know, things like that where there was instability. And this literally is like it rolls off the table. If you guys go to the Time Track site just following Obama, you see how definitely what you're saying here between 2010 and 2011 is hardly any activity. Then
right.
All of a sudden, he kind of rises from the ashes here in 2013.
The thing is, where that transition spot occurs in 2010, 2011, there's some kind of a significant change there. The question is, how serious is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because the drop off doesn't mean he disappears completely. What it can mean is, you know, I mean, we could look at this from the positive standpoint and say, well, suppose, you know, the financial fix actually works, and the second dip in the recession that they've been talking about doesn't happen, and the Republicans are left with nobody but Sarah Palin to nominate in 2012, you know.
I went to her chart next, and she's off the radar.
Well, yes, you know, when Sarah Palin, when she surfaced, and it's funny, I think I told you the other night that my kid,
yeah,
who's in his early 20s, finishing up at Fordham, told me about 6 or 8 weeks before McCain even mentioned this woman that he thought that that McCain's best bet would be to pick Sarah Palin. And I said, who? Sarah who? Wait, what? You know, never heard of her, didn't know who she was, even after he told me I didn't know. So it was like, what? And then, sure enough, that's exactly what happened. But when we ran Sarah Palin, what we saw was this was going to be a flash in the pan. This was not somebody who had long-term potentials, and we figured that within, certainly before 2012, she would become, maybe a media star. She might end up with a talk show or something, to compete with Oprah or something. But I mean, beyond that, the chances of her succeeding in the presidency, thankfully, is very slim. I would probably put it in the less than 5 percentile, but anyway.
Well, she seems to hit a wall there at the end of 2010, which is around the midterms, so maybe we have to put up with her for another year. Tina Fey gets a couple more opportunities, and then she kind of goes off the table there.
Well, that's right.
Up around 2014 there, somewhere.
That's right. She's certainly an interesting character. But, you know, so's Kiki Friedman. And, I mean, but we're not going to nominate them for president. So it's, you know, that I looked at her and said, well, here's John McCain's Harriet Myers. And, I mean, a lot of my Republican clients, by the time we got to the fall election last year, they were so disgusted that I think they all secretly voted for Obama. They didn't admit it, but I'm pretty sure that that's either that or they stayed home. So, you know, with the Republican Party largely in disarray, although you'd never know it if you listened to right-wing radio, Palin is the only bright star on the horizon, essentially, for them. Who else is out there? Mitt Romney is dull and boring. Huckabee's probably not going anywhere. McCain's too old at this point. There's really nobody for the Republicans to turn to. Then when they have somebody, they end up with a sex scandal. So, you know,
I don't have much sympathy for him, tell you the truth. But
well, I don't either. I don't either. I think after Bush, they got what they deserved.
Is Ron Paul on this list? Is he over there? Let me see.
Actually, Ron Paul is in the system. I don't know whether he's posted or not, but he's in the system. Ron Paul actually, and Fred Thompson, had a better chance of being successful in the 08 election than the people they actually picked. What we thought, what Dr. Hart and I, our favorite candidate for last year, was Mike Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if he wasn't convinced he was going to rain on the parade of the first Afro-American who had a serious shot at the presidency, he would have run. But,
well, they were talking about him for vice president briefly, and then he moved on.
I know they were. Yeah. And actually, Obama, I think, considered him for vice president.
And this whole notion of an independent party, I don't know if you can track an idea like that. Because a lot of the stuff we're talking about here, and again, we're talking to Paul Garcia from the Merlin Project, has to do with the subjective experience of time as opposed to the objective experience that we all go by, you know, the old Swiss timing from the Olympics, where we're watching everything on a very linear track. These are kind of like a waveform that we're looking at here, and some of the time trackers, if you go to the site and check them out.
Well,
it is
something
a little
else,
like reading music. Hmm?
Right, there's something else that's useful to know about this, and not only for you know, comparing political candidates.
Right.
If time really works like this, and George and I are convinced that it does, that actually what we were able to tease out in a fairly crude way. I mean, we recognize this as crude. But what we think we teased out here is what every civilization has noticed since the beginning of time, and has developed some technology around it. I mean, numerology, astrology, runes, I mean, you could go on and on. They all have something in common. And the thing that they have in common most is factors of time. Like the biblical seven lean years and fat years, for instance, where did that come from exactly? Well, if you do some hunting around, you find out that everything follows that time pattern. It's not base 10 like we normally pay attention to, you know, fifth and 10th and 20th anniversaries and 20. It's actually 7 and 21 and 42 and 84. Those are the increments that really matter. And if we actually take a look at events in our own lives, we'll find that they happen in those increments. So something that you did 7 years ago is coming up for some kind of renewal or reprise right now. Something you did 20 or 21 years ago is going through some very large reprise because events of the 20, 21 years ago in your life are coming back. People from that period are resurfacing. Events and things that you began maybe never finished in that window are being reprised. And same thing at the 42-year interval and the 84-year interval. Those time patterns, when you actually apply them to a lifetime, you find that most of the major events in our lives happen in those increments. So if a huge event happened to you at 3, then 3 plus 7 plus 21 plus 42 is going to be monumentally important in your life. And the problem is that each of us has the major events happen in our own particular time. So for you it might be 3, for somebody else it might have been right at birth, for somebody else it might have been at 5 or 7. But whatever the first real large, you know, kaboom that happened, where you lost a parent, or where you had some near miss physically, or you had some illness that you almost died from, or whatever it is, if you take that increment and then you add 7 and 21 and 42 and 84 to it, you find that at those junctures, other major events are going to cluster. And by knowing where those are going to be, you can start to plan for them. You can take advantage of them, or you can at least know when to duck. That's the advantage.
I'll give you one in my life that maybe will illustrate this for you. 87, I have an operation on my neck for a cold mass on my thyroid, hit the throat plant, hockey, right? So that's 87. 7 years later, my son is born with heart anomalies that leave him with a paralyzed vocal cord.
Uh-huh.
You know,
well,
that's a little
87 and 21 would have been 08.
Yeah, that was a fun year, too. You know, for both of us, he actually, that was a year that he made a lot of progress, and I made a lot of progress, too. So it's like, this is what gets into the intersubjectivity of Merlin, where you're not just alone in this time wave. You're playing off of other people's song here, and there's this, like I said, this tapestry. That's why when you track a Hillary with an Obama, or you track, you start seeing how lives can literally influence other lives, and then if you
absolutely
have the conversation going on in the subtext, and like you're saying, if you have the perspective to be able to anticipate hills and valleys, it's almost like we live in a flat map world where we see I-95 as a line, and when you travel on 95, you'll know that the Stuckey's that, you know, down in North Carolina has good biscuits and gravy, but the one over here in Greensboro, you know, is a little lousy, and the bathroom from traveling. You'll know the terrain, and that's the experiential three-dimensional aspect of time that we will get pushed into the woo and pushed into the, you know, the spooky stuff from the scientific community. Now, you guys, by using an algorithm like this and being able to illustrate sort of the profile that these things take, now you start getting to the point where you're actually you're not reading tea leaves. You're looking at things that is, to me, much more accurate and precise than weather forecasts and farmers.
Oh, for sure. And there's also one other thing, and that is that since we can generate a generic snapshot of any given day in the future,
mm-hmm.
we can find a moment in the future that's going to be particularly useful because it matches patterns that you have that nobody else has.
Mm-hmm.
So we can find a date in the future, for instance, for you to start a business or make an investment or get married or get divorced or whatever it is that's going to be advantageous to you because it's going to deliver up to you a moment of time that has a high degree of familiarity to it. It's like finding another moment like you arrived here in that is going to give you a kind of time capsule to catch a ride on, and it'll give you a much better ride than it would have given someone whose time pattern doesn't match that.
Well, and along the lines of that moment stuff, like, you know, clicking around on the time track site, you finally once and for all address the issue of this 2012 stuff that I sat through and watched, you know, for what seemed like a 2.5-year movie on Sunday. and true to form, this thing has so much attention and so much of the consciousness of the tinfoil population and some of the mainstreamers that are paying their $10 to watch what's-his-name run all over the planet.
Well, you know, the thing about that is that I was not aware of that end of the Mayan calendar story until probably 5 or 6 years ago. I wasn't really paying it.
You'd have every book.
Well,
on the
you'd
like,
think so.
Charlie
you'd
Frost
think so.
Movie.
Yeah, you'd think so. But it wasn't something. I mean, to give you an example, if you actually do some checking, the end of the world has been predicted on the record about 3,200 times.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Goner Ted Armstrong alone predicted it 6 times, you know. So I mean, the likelihood of that happening is when you get into the kind of thing George and I have been doing, you kind of roll your eyes when somebody says, "Well, you know, the Mayans predicted the end of the world in 2012." You kind of go, "Yeah, right." But what we did was about 5 or 6 years ago, we took that date, December 22nd, 2012, and 21st. We ran it. Excuse me?
That was December 21st.
Well, I think we ran the 22nd.
The Earth ends. Okay.
Doesn't it say 22nd on ours? I think it does. But anyway,
I think it does. Yeah.
Right at the bottom of the list of stuff for on the homepage of the Time Tracks is the Mayan calendar run.
Right.
I think we ran it in 2004 originally, and I believe we ran it for 12/22/12. I believe that's what we did. I don't have it in front of me right now, but
yeah, 12/22.
Right. What we wanted to see was what would happen. What did the years leading up to that actually look like? So, in other words, we ran it kind of backwards from that date back to closer to 2004. Just to see, well, do the years leading up to 2012 suggest anything unusual? I mean, does it look, you know, normal, or does it look extraordinary in some way? What's really, really interesting about that is that mountain range of activity that you see starting in 07 and 08 and then peaking in 2011, basically, is remarkably similar to the time tracks that we ran when we first popped this thing out in 88 and 89. And what we ran performance graphs on in that period was the old Soviet Union. We ran the founding dates of Estonia and Latvia and East Germany and on all of the Soviet satellite countries. We went and established what their founding date was, and then we ran a time track on that founding date. And what those time tracks looked like, what we were looking at in the summer and fall of 1989, before any of what later happened. No, the Berlin Wall hadn't come down yet, and, you know, Ceausescu was still in office, and et cetera, et cetera. What we saw when we ran those was a graphic that looks remarkably like that Mayan calendar run, where there was a huge mountain range of activity on time track after time track after time track of the Soviet satellite countries. So what George and I were looking at in the late summer and early fall of 89, prior to any of that stuff actually happening, was something that George saying to me, "Well, we got three possibilities here. Either this thing just doesn't work and we're seeing a lot of noise, or we're seeing the end of communism, or we're seeing World War III." And you know,
that's
take your pick.
Menu. Yeah, right.
Okay. And then we proceeded to sit back and watch communism go out of business. And we were probably the only people on the planet who not only knew that it was going to happen, but knew what the timetable was going to be like. And we sat and we watched this mirror the timetable of these graphs, which had been created prior to any of this going on. And the only reason we ran it on the Soviet satellites and whatnot is because in the spring of 89, there was Tiananmen Square, and in the previous fall and spring, there was the uprising in Poland in the shipyards that Lech Walesa was involved with,
right,
that suggested that maybe we were at a turning point in terms of communism that might lead to some kind of breakthrough. Well, we had no idea the size of the breakthrough we were about to be looking at. And I can remember that George would run these things out of this think tank he was working at and leave them behind the screen door of his house, which was about halfway between where he worked and where I was working. And he would leave them there for me to pick them up the next morning, and he would put Post-its on them. And I can remember the Post-it that I picked up in early October, I think, of 89. It said, "If you like China, you're going to love East Germany."
And then
it all collapsed.
Right.
And we were sitting there literally with our mouths hanging open like, oh, my God, this turned out to have been right. Okay, and not only was it right, it was so right, we were the only ones who had a clue as to how big a change it was going to be and how quickly it happened.
So mapping this to the 2012 thing, when you see a similar mountain of activity, like you say, then nothing, were you just seeing the end of that idea that we're here, we're okay, the end of the world, or some fundamental shift in consciousness that they've been talking about that isn't about destruction, it's more about a renewal or a creativity that we're
Well, it could be a little of all of those things. For instance, this fellow that Vasiago, who just actually got in touch with me, is, there's crazy lawyers, but generally lawyers are a little bit less crazy than a lot of other people. If he's a successful practicing lawyer, he's got to at least have his head screwed on relatively straight.
One foot in the world, yeah.
Here, exactly. And here he's saying that between 7 and 11, he had these experiences with this government agency, and the agency, as I said, was DARPA, that has a reputation for getting involved in some pretty strange stuff. So if there's truth to what he says, and now I have an opportunity to connect him up with this former Secretary of Defense, who probably has access to that information, or can gain access to it. Here's a guy who would have, real-time stories about things like extraterrestrials and little grays and reverse engineering of flying machines and so on. If there's anything to that, here's somebody that would actually have been there at the time. So we may very well see some of that. The same thing is true with this pandemic. My dad may turn out to be right. He came in with the great pandemic of 1917-18 and may leave with this one. It would make sense. The same thing would be true with finding out that global warming, and, I get really annoyed with some of these right-wingers who say, well, what is this global warming? It's colder than it's been. It snowed on the Patriots. 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago.
Right, right.
Well, yeah, because if you actually know anything about global warming, it gets warm in some areas, all right, but other areas end up having, ice ages.
Well,
so,
the theme of that 2012 movie was is that with the sunspot activity and all that the polarity of the Earth changes, and there's a lot of physics to this. And there's
well,
a lot of movie to it, but
I'll tell you,
the physics is fun.
The movie that came out a couple of years ago, called The Day After Tomorrow.
Yes, I love
it. I think that movie does a pretty good job of capturing the essence of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing we'd have to actually worry about, not so much. Global warming in the context of just rising oceans and whatnot, because one of the things that is definitely true is that our weather is determined largely by these things like the Japanese current and the Bermuda current and so on, And those flows in the ocean that move warmer water into colder areas and so on are affected by the temperature of the water and the level of salt in it. And as the ice cap begins to continues to melt, it's changing that level of salinization. So that and that movie, The Day After Tomorrow, that's really what that movie is all about. That the changes in those flows all of a sudden had an enormous impact and rather rapidly on Earth's weather. So we may get to see a whole bunch of stuff in here. First, real admission on the part of the governments that there have been visitations from elsewhere. A really serious pandemic cutting across all lines. We may see religion may go through both a renaissance and a period of serious decay, because it's going to be hard to explain. You take extraterrestrials, try to mix that in with with the rules of the road in Christianity or Buddhism or Islam, and I noticed that recently, in the last couple of weeks, the Vatican is running around trying to figure out how they would handle the appearance of extraterrestrials. Well, what made them do that all of a sudden? That's very unusual for the Vatican to be even talking about that, much less seriously looking into it. So there's got to be some tip-off going on there. And with the time track that shows this last couple of years of the decade and the first couple of years of the next one being this enormous mountain range, you have to look at that and say, well, there's got to be something about this that is not typical. And what would qualify as being not typical on a fairly broad scale? And some of these things that have been suggested, whether they are, pandemics or extraterrestrial, admissions of extraterrestrial, life, religion going through a renaissance, et cetera. And frankly, the first Afro-American president.
Yeah, we've had a lot of new the last little while here leading up to this. Like we've
absolutely
been around the board the last couple of years.
That's right.
Going through bang, 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 all over the place.
That's exactly right. Somebody said, well, how did this Barack Obama thing happen? And it happened because we had George Bush for 8 years. If it hadn't been for George Bush, we would not have Barack Obama.
Right. One thing has to lead to the other.
We went from one extreme to the other,
right.
Basically.
Yeah, and again, a lot of the stuff that we're talking about here, again, we're talking to Paul Garcia from the Merlin Project, has to do with the oscillations within time, not just the chronological journey through, which is what we tend to do. We tend to put time on a line instead of on a wave and not understand the cyclical nature of this. That's what we've been getting into here.
That's right.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, the one of the things that's clearly obvious when you start to pay attention to this is that time is not this vanilla, flat phenomenon. All Mondays are not the same as all other Mondays, and so on. What I've pointed out to people about the way we deal with time is that we deal with time mostly in terms of when we don't have to work. So on that basis, all Fridays are better than all Mondays, all 5 p.m.s are better than all 9 a.m.s, and so on. But that's about the best we do. What's really true is that time is a rising, falling flow of events and potential. And each moment seems to have its own particular set of characteristics. So when things begin in one moment as opposed to another, the outcomes are going to be different. And what we do with clients is we say, look, if you pick your moments on purpose instead of by accident, you get to control some of that.
Yeah, and again, this is about participation, anticipation, and most of us are kind of schooled and conditioned to be very reactive, and almost be almost kind of oblivious to the synchronicity that goes on, and then we go and consult some 500-year-old map like astrology or something like that, or 2,000-year-old map, you know, to try to understand it. And of course, its correlation is weak, and we go through 500 of those things until we're back staring in the mirror, going, "What's happening to me?"
Right. That's right.
When if you had this fundamental awareness, you wouldn't be panicking so much. And some of the stuff you bring in your article, people get from the website of how the future happens. Is to deal with the influences that sort of will delete and kind of put things into a little bit of distortion about how we experience time, personal laws, which is belief system stuff we've been talking about, and then these fixed boundaries that are the external parameters that control, you know, the way we move through our experiences, that are going to be things like gravity, things that we can't.
Right, exactly. The stuff that you can't, the stuff you can't really manipulate. And
right.
And what I point out to clients is, look, if you're going to have any control over what happens in your life, you better understand what the variables are, first of all, and which ones you control and which ones you don't, so that you don't waste a lot of time trying to control things you can't control. Okay, so what we do is we say, look, here are the variables, here are the ones that you have an ability to manipulate, and essentially those boil down to picking your moments on purpose and approaching those moments with a different headset, let's say, than you approached a moment like that the last time. Because the attitude and set of expectations and belief systems and sense of possibility is going to affect the way that moment performs for you. What we found, for instance, about lucky people is that lucky people are people who make changes in their life when there's no reason to.
Yeah, and again, they're doing it instinctively and intuitively. You've made this thing somewhat, you know, cognitive and intellectual. So
well, we've given people a cheat sheet, basically.
Right, right. And this is one of the things I want to close the show with, because this is something that everyone can do, because people are going to be going out in a month to buy their calendars for 2010, plague aside. and basically, yeah, if you're in the Ukraine, you might want to get your calendar now.
right.
Basically, you might only have a couple of days. Basically, what you get is you take your chronological calendar out, and then you look at your birthday, and you basically go, like, I'll use mine as an example, 12/28. So you write down a list of 12 dates, starting with your birthday. And so it's every month, 1/28, 2/28, 3/28, all the way through the whole year, ending with 11/28. Now, what you say is that every 60 days, you know, around your birthday, there's a lucky period, 3 to 4 weeks around each date, total of four, what you call green dates, that are sort of, you know, lack of stress, there's kind of an ease to them, and this is where there's opportunity. So for me, the red dates would be lines, 1, 4, hang on here a second.
Right.
Four, seven, and ten. So it'd be December, March, June, and September are red zones for me.
Here's a good reference point. And
yeah.
You're very close to the first day of spring with that. So your dates are going to mirror the equinoxes and the solstices.
Right.
Okay, within a few days, basically.
Yeah,
right. And mine too, because I'm end of September. So end of September, end of December, end of March, end of June are going to be those same spots. But for the rest of your audience, I found that they have a very difficult time figuring out what month is opposite what month. Okay, so the easiest way to actually do it is say, look, whatever your birthday is, the date exactly opposite your birthday, and the dates 90 days before and after your birthday that would essentially be the compass points.
Right.
If your birthday was the first day of spring, those would be the compass points. So those dates, every 90 days after your birthday and including your birthday,
mm-hmm.
are going to be windows of time when your ability to choose you know, buy things that are going to work out and make investments that are going to turn out to be productive and get involved in relationships that are going to work out and so on. Your ability to choose is somewhat diminished. There's a diminished ability to make good choices. So if you buy a car at those times, you're more likely to buy a lemon. If you change jobs, you're more likely to have that new job produce problems or leave you, you know, with a problem of concern that you're gonna get laid off or something shortly
right.
after you take the job. Those time frames are going to be true every year. They're going to work for about maybe a week or two either side of whatever those target dates are. And if you simply avoid those dates, forget the other dates even, forget all the green dates and all the rest of the stuff, just those dates alone. If you avoid those dates, if you don't make major purchases then, don't make big moves, don't change jobs, don't change relationships, and just simply wait till you get out of those periods to make the change, you'll make fewer changes that go against you than if you make them willy-nilly.
Well, you're taking a lot of the noise and interference out because you're saying those you know, periods of time during the year, you're going to experience, you know, some internal, you know, kind of cloudiness because your system's rebooting in a way. And then for me, February, April, August, and October, I'm going to get kind of the wind at my back for a couple of weeks.
That's
things
right.
are going to come to me easier. I'm going to be more apt to just, like, have things just kind of naturally fall. So if you're charting it out, and you guys are coming out with this Merlin Book of Days that people can go and actually get this thing done. Because for me, I don't just have to deal with my birthday. My daughter's born on January 1st, and my son's born on January 13th. So we're all kind of in the same loop for almost a month.
Well,
hard to cope with.
I'm September 30th, and my son is October 4th, and my daughter's September 22nd. So I know exactly what that's like. Yes, that's right.
We were given the brain of a squirrel to deal with that, so we can cope.
Well, the other thing about this is that there have been clients over the years who have gotten back to me, especially after now doing some of these shows where you're heard all over the place, and they've said to me that what they've done with this information is that they've figured out what the red dates are for all of the people they have to deal with on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And they give them a lot of space at those times of the year. They don't engage them in arguments or problems. They don't take them to task over things. They don't go in and ask their boss for a raise at those times when he's having one of those. And the report that I've gotten of people who've watched this now for like 30 years has said that knowing that one piece of information has saved them from all kinds of grief. And a number of them have said to me, you know, I think I'm going to end up living longer because the amount of stress I was able to eliminate by not doing things at those times, not engaging those people in those windows. And conversely, these other dates that you might think of as being lucky dates or periods that have an up quality. It's not that the times are better. It's that your ability to choose increases. So you're more likely to choose things that are going to turn out to be favorable to your cause than if you pick other times to do those things. And that basically is every 60 days after your birthday, with the exception of your birthday, and the date exactly opposite your birthday. So
and again, we're going to wrap it up here, Paul, because we're running out of time, actually, coincidentally. So anyone wants to get that PDF, you can go download it from Paul's site. And anyone that missed Dan's information or wants to get it repeated, you can contact me at nakedsoma@gmail.com. Thanks, Paul. We could go on for hours. We'll probably have to do another show soon. We'll figure out this bubonic plague together.
Have a good one.
And, well, thanks for joining us here in Soma Time, and have a great Thanksgiving. We'll talk to you soon. Okay, guys, take care. Thanks a lot. Looks like we're wrapping up the show. So we will see you next Wednesday night for the Big Bad Thanksgiving Hour. We're going to kind of review things and get ourselves set up for for December as we continue to evolve here on Summertime. Thanks again for this time and your space. I'm Dr. Mark. Be yourself and be well.
When you can fall the chains of silver, you can fall the chains of gold, you can fall for pretty strangers and the promises they hold. You promised me everything. You promised me looking thin, yeah. Now you just say, oh, Romeo, yeah. You know, I used to have a dream with him. Oh, yeah. When we made love,
travel on, sapiens.